But she's not good enough, one of them said. Dr. Cates isn't the best doctor for that child. Ellie smiled and pushed them out the door, locking it behind them. When it was quiet again, the dogs started to whine upstairs. Julia could hear them pacing outside the bedroom door. Alice is upset. The dogs always respond to her emotions. I should get back. Ellie moved forward fast, touched Julia's arm. Are you okay? Fine. I should have expected it. Mort's picture and the press conference. My past. There are all kinds of doctors who would use Alice to advance their careers. On that, her voice finally broke. Don't let them get to you, Ellie said. You're helping that little girl. Julia looked down at her sister. I missed things with Amber. Important things. Maybe. Don't, Ellie said. They want you to question yourself, to lose confidence. Don't let them win. Julia sighed. She felt as if she were melting from the inside out, shrinking. It's not a game. It's her life. If I'm not the best doctor for her, go back upstairs, Jules. Do what you do best. Ellie smiled. You hear that howling? That's her, telling you she needs you. You! I'm afraid. We're all afraid. To that, Julia had no answer. With another heavy sigh, she left the living room and went upstairs. In the hallway, the dogs were going crazy, whining and howling and running into each other. Alice's low, keening growl could be heard through the door. Julia paused, trying to refind her confidence. In its place, she found a fake smile and shaking hands. Pushing past the dogs, she went into her old bedroom. Alice immediately stopped howling. I need to know if you can speak. It's getting desperate, actually. To Julia's horror, her voice broke on that last revealing word. All the emotions she'd tamped down and stored away rose again. All she could think about now was her failure with Amber. She wiped her eyes, although no tears had fallen. I'm sorry, Alice. It's just been a bad day. She went to the table and sat down, needing the safe harbor of her profession. She studied her notes, trying to concentrate. At first, the touch was so soft that Julia failed to notice. She looked down. Alice was staring up at her, stroking Julia's arm. She wiped her eyes, although she wasn't crying. Sympathy. Alice was offering sympathy. The child had recognized her sadness and wanted to alleviate it. She was connecting, answering in the only way she knew how. Suddenly, none of the rest of it mattered. Julia felt a wave of gratitude to this poor, strange little girl who had just reached out to her, reminded her that she made a difference. No ugly headlines or ambitious doctors or unfeeling child welfare system could steal that from her. She touched Alice's soft, scarred cheek. Thank you. Alice flinched at the touch. She started to pull away, probably so that she could go hide among the plants again. Stay, Julia said, grasping her frail, thin wrist. Please? Her voice broke on the sharp desperation of that word. Alice drew in a deep, shaky breath and stared at Julia. You know that word, don't you? Stay. I need something from you too, Alice. I need to help you. They sat that way for a long time, staring at each other. You're not autistic, are you? Julia said finally. You're worried about my feelings. Now, how about I return the favor? You tell me something secret, and I'll be here for you. 15. For the next 2 weeks, the story of the disgraced doctor and the nameless, voiceless girl was headline news. The phones at the police station were jammed with calls from doctors, psychiatrists, and counselors, kooks, and scientists. Everyone, it seemed, wanted to save Alice from Julia's incompetence. Doctors Kletch and Goldberg called daily. The Department of Social and Health Services required updates twice a week. They were beginning to suggest residential care at almost every turn. Julia worked 18 hours a day. She was with Alice from sunup to sundown. After the child fell asleep, she went to the library and spent more hours in front of a computer screen or online. Everything she did was for Alice. On Wednesdays and Fridays, like clockwork, she went to the police station, where she conducted a press conference. She stood at that podium, inches from the microphones that amplified her words. She told them every aspect of Alice's treatment, offered every identity hint that was revealed. None of it interested them. They asked endless questions about Julia's past, about her regrets and failures and lost patience. They cared nothing for the milestones of Alice's recovery. Still, Julia tried. She reached for me today. She buttoned her blouse. She pointed at a bird. She used a fork. All that mattered to the reporters was that Alice hadn't spoken. To them, it was more proof that Julia could no longer be trusted to help even one troubled child. But in time, even the rehashing of Julia's past began to lose momentum. The stories went from headline news on page one to a paragraph or two in the local interest or life sections. Local water cooler conversation left the unknown girl behind. Now the mini quakes shaking Mount St. Helens were on everyone's mind. From her podium, Julia stared out at the few reporters in the police station. CNN, USA Today, the New York Times, and the national television stations weren't here anymore. Only a few of the local papers were left, and most of them were from small peninsula communities like Rain Valley. Their questions were still pointed and cruel, but they were asked in dull, monotone voices. No one expected any of it to matter anymore. That's all for this week, Julia said, realizing the room had gone still. The big news is that she can dress herself, and she shows a true affinity for anything made of plastic. She can take or leave television. I think the images move too quickly for her, but she can watch cooking programs all day. Maybe that will strike a chord with someone. Come on, Dr. Cates, said a man at the back of the room. He was desperately thin, with shaggy hair and a mouth made for cigarettes. No one is looking for this kid. There was a murmur of assent from the crowd as they talked among themselves. Julia heard the papery rustle of their laughter. That's not true. A child doesn't simply appear and disappear in this world. Someone is missing her. A man from KIRO-TV stepped forward. The compassion in his dark eyes was almost harder to bear than the disinterest of his colleagues. I don't know what's true about your past and what's media spin, Dr. Cates, but I know that you're a smart woman. There's something wrong with this kid, big time wrong. I think that's why her family dumped her in the woods and walked away. Julia stepped out from behind the podium and moved toward him. You have no evidence to support that. It's just as likely that she was kidnapped so long ago that her family has given up on her, stopped looking. His gaze was steady. Stopped looking for their daughter? If. I wish you luck, I really do, but KIRO is pulling out. The rumblings at Mount St. Helens are front and center now. He reached into his rumpled white shirt pocket and withdrew a card. My wife's a therapist. I'll be fair to you. Call me if you find out something substantive. She looked down at his card. John Smith, TV News. KIRO, she knew, had a top-notch research staff and access to people and places she couldn't begin to reach. How hard did you guys try to find out who she is? 4 researchers worked on it full time for the first 2 weeks. Julia nodded. She'd been afraid of that. Good luck. She watched him leave, thinking, and there goes the last of the good ones. Next Wednesday, she'd be giving her update to representatives of local newspapers, with smaller circulations than most high schools, and, if she was lucky, some low-rent stringer for the tabloids. Peanut crossed the room, weaving through the row of metal folding chairs, picking up the discarded news releases they'd handed out. Her black rubber clogs made a thumping sound on the floor. Cal went along behind her, grabbing the chairs, clanging them shut. Within moments, the podium was the only remaining evidence of today's press conference. Soon there would be no audience for any of this. The pressure of that knowledge had been building in Julia, filling her lungs like a slow-growing case of pneumonia. The milestones she'd reported to the media today were important. In ordinary therapy, the amount of progress Alice had made in 3 weeks would be considered successful. Now the child could eat with utensils and use the toilet. She'd even come so far as to show sympathy for someone else. But none of it answered the central question of identity. None of it would get Alice back to her family and her real life. None of it would guarantee that Julia could keep working with her. In fact, with every day that passed in the child's silence, Julia felt her grasp on her confidence loosen. At night, as she lay in her bed, listening to Alice's quiet nightmares and violent moments, Julia thought, am I good enough? Or worse, what am I missing this time?
You did a great job today, Peanut said, trying to force a smile. It was the same thing she'd said after each press conference.
Thanks, was Julia's standard answer. I better get back, she said, bending down for her briefcase. Peanut nodded, then yelled to Cal,
I'm taking her home.
Julia followed Peanut out of the station and into the gunmetal gray light of sundown. In the car, they both stared straight ahead. Garth Brooks's voice floated through the speakers, complaining about friends in low places.
So, I guess it isn't going so well, huh?
Peanut said, strumming her black-and-white checkerboard fingernails on the steering wheel at the 4-way stop. She's made huge progress, but
she still isn't talking. Are you sure she can?
The same series of questions ran like an endless monologue through Julia's thoughts. Day and night, she thought, can she? Will she? When? I believe it with my whole heart, Julia said slowly. Then she smiled ruefully. My head is beginning to wander, however.
When I was a young mother, the thing I hated most was changing diapers. So the day my Tara turned 2, I set about teaching her to use the toilet. I followed all the how-to books down to the letter. And you know what happened? My Tara stopped pooping. Just stopped. After about 5 days, I took her to Doc Fisher. I was worried sick. He examined my baby girl, then looked at me over his glasses. He said, Penelope Nutter, this girl is trying to tell you something. She doesn't want to be potty trained.
Peanut laughed, then hit the turn signal and veered onto the old highway.
There's no metal on earth stronger than a child's will. I guess your Alice will talk when she's ready.
Peanut turned down their driveway and pulled up in front of the house, honking twice. Ellie came out of the house almost immediately, So quickly, in fact, that Julia suspected she'd been at the door, waiting.
Thanks for the ride, Peanut.
See you Wednesday.
Julia got out of the car and slammed the door shut. She met Ellie halfway across the yard.
She's howling again, Ellie said miserably.
When did she wake up?
5 minutes ago. She's early. How'd it go?
Bad, she said, trying to sound strong and failing.
The DNA results will be back soon. Maybe they will give us an answer. If she's a kidnap victim, there will be crime scene evidence to compare to.
They'd tossed this idea back and forth like a life ring in the last few days, though it had lost its buoyancy.
I know. Hopefully she's in the system.
It was what Julia always said.
Hopefully.
They looked at each other. The word was starting to sound frayed. Julia went into the house and up the stairs. With each step, the howling grew in volume. She knew what she'd find when she entered her room. Alice would be kneeling behind her plants, head down, face in her hands, rocking and howling. It was her only means of expressing sadness or fear. She was afraid now because she'd wakened alone. To an ordinary child, this might be frustrating. To Alice, it was terrifying. Julia was already talking when she opened the door.
Now, what's all this racket about, Alice? Everything is fine. You're just scared.
That's natural.
Alice streaked across the room in a blur of black hair, yellow dress, and spindly arms and legs. She pressed herself against Julia so closely that there was contact from waist to calf. Alice put her hand in Julia's pocket. This was how it was lately. Alice needed to be next to Julia always, connected. She was sucking her thumb and looking up at Julia with a vulnerability that was both heartbreaking and terrifying.
Come on, Alice, Julia said, pretending it was perfectly natural to have a young human barnacle attached to her hip.
She got out her Denver kit, a collection of toys that were helpful in gauging a child's development. At the table, she set out the bell, the block, and the doll.
Sit down, Alice, she said,
knowing Alice would sit down when she did. The chairs were close enough that they could still be together. Side by side, with Alice's tiny hand still tucked in Julia's pocket, they sat down. With the Denver kit spread out in front of them, Julia waited for Alice to make a move.
Come on, Julia said. I need you to talk, little one. I know you can do it.
Nothing. Just the gentle in and out of the girl's breathing. Desperation plucked at Julia's confidence, broke a tender strand of it.
Please.
Her voice was a whisper now, not her therapist voice at all. She thought about the passing of time and the dwindling media interest and the increasingly quiet phone lines in the police station.
Please, come on.
When Ellie and Peanut arrived at the police station, the building was quiet. Cal was at his desk, headphones on his head, drawing a picture of some winged creature. At their entrance, he turned the paper face down. As if Ellie cared to see his bizarre sketches, he'd been doing them since sixth grade. The only difference between him and every other guy she'd ever known was that Cal had never outgrown it. There were always doodles on her pink while you were out messages.
Earl signed out, Cal said, pushing a lock of hair out of his eyes. Mel is going to make one more pass out toward the lake to check on the teens, and then he's off too.
In other words, life in Rain Valley was back to normal. The phones weren't ringing, and her two patrol officers were off unless someone called in.
And the DNA results are back. I put them on your desk.
Ellie stopped. They all looked at one another. After a long moment, she went to her desk and sat down. The chair squeaked in protest. She picked up the official-looking envelope and opened it.
The pages inside had a lot of mumbo-jumbo scientist speak, but none of it mattered. At the midsection was the sentence, "No match found." The second page was a lab report on the dress fibers. As expected, it revealed only that the dress was made of inexpensive white cotton that could have come from any of a dozen textile mills. There were no blood or semen traces in the fabric, no DNA present. The final paragraph of the report outlined the procedure to be followed in the event that the DNA collected from Alice was to be tested against a found sample. Ellie felt a wave of defeat. What now? She'd done everything she knew. Hell, she'd thrown her sister to the wolves, and for what? They were no closer to an ID now than they'd been 3 weeks ago, and the people at DSHS were breathing down her neck. Cal and Peanut pulled chairs across the room and sat in front of the desk.
"No ID?" Peanut asked.
Ellie shook her head, unable to say it out loud.
"You did the best you could," Cal said gently. "No one could have done any better," Peanut agreed.
After that, no one spoke. A real rarity here. Finally, Ellie pushed the papers across her desk. "Send these results out to the people who are waiting. How many requests have we gotten?"
33. Maybe one of them is the match," Peanut said hopefully.
Ellie opened her desk drawer and pulled out the stack of papers she'd gotten from the National Center for Missing Children. She'd read it at least 100 times, using it as the only guidance she could find. The final paragraph had been burned into her brain. She didn't need to read it again to know what it said. "If none of this produces a positive identification of the child, then social services should be called in. The child will most likely be placed in a permanent foster home or a residential treatment facility or adopted out."
"What do we do next?" Peanut asked.
Ellie sighed. "We pray this DNA produces a match." They all knew how unlikely that was. None of the 33 requests had seemed particularly promising. Most of them had been made by people, parents and lawyers and cops from other jurisdictions, who believed the child being sought was dead. None of them had described Alice's birthmark. Ellie rubbed her eyes.
"Let's pack it in for the night. You can send out the DNA reports tomorrow, P. I have another phone conference with the lady from DSHS. That should be fun."
Peanut stood up.
"I'm meeting Benji at the Big Bowl. Anyone want to join me?"
"There's nothing I like better than hanging around with fat men in matching polyester shirts," said Cal. "I'm in."
Peanut glared at him.
"You want me to tell Benji you called him fat?"
Cal laughed. "It'll come as no surprise to him, P."
"Don't get started, you two," Ellie said tiredly. The last thing she wanted to listen to was a he said, she said fight over nothing.
"I'm going home. You should too, Cal. It's Friday night. The girls will miss you."
The girls and Lisa went to Aberdeen to see her folks. "I'm a bachelor this weekend. So, it's the Big Bowl for me."
He looked at her.
"You used to love bowling."
Ellie found herself remembering the summer she and Cal had worked at the Big Bowl's lunch counter. It had been that last magical year of childhood, before all the sharp edges of adolescence poked through. They'd been outcasts together that summer, best friends, in the way that only two social rejects can be. The next summer, she'd been too cool for the Big Bowl.
"That was a long time ago, Cal. I can't believe you remember it."
"I remember."
There was an edge to his voice that was odd. He walked over to the hooks by the door and grabbed his coat.
"It's karaoke night," Peanut said, smiling.
Ellie was lost, and Peanut damn well knew it.
"I guess a margarita couldn't hurt."
It was better than going home. The thought of telling Julia about the DNA
was more than she could bear. On either side of River Road, giant Douglas fir trees were an endless black saw blade of sharp tips and serrated edges. Overhead, the sky was cut into bite-sized pieces by treetops and mountain peaks. There were stars everywhere, some bright and so close you felt certain their light would reach down to the soggy earth. But when Ellie looked at her feet, there was only dark gravel beneath her. She giggled. For a second, she'd almost expected to look down and see a black mist there.
"Slow down," Cal said, coming around the car. He took hold of Ellie's arm, steadying her.
She couldn't seem to stop looking at the sky. Her head felt heavy. So, too, her eyelids.
"You see the Big Dipper?"
It was directly to the left and above her house.
"My dad used to say that God used it to pour magic down our chimney."
Her voice cracked on that. The memory surprised her. She hadn't had time to raise her shield.
"This is why I don't drink."
Cal put an arm around her.
"I thought you didn't drink because of the senior prom. Remember when you puked on Principal Haley?"
"I need new friends,"
Ellie muttered. She let herself be guided into the house, where the dogs rammed into her so hard she almost fell again.
"Jake! Elwood!"
She bent down and hugged them, letting them lick her cheek until it was so wet it felt like she'd been swimming.
"You need to train those dogs," Cal said, stepping away from their sniffing noses.
"Training anything with a penis is impossible,"
she grinned at him.
"And you thought I didn't learn anything from my marriages?"
She pointed to the stairs.
"Upstairs, boys. I'll be right up."
She only had to say it another 15 times before they obeyed. Once the dogs were gone, Cal said, "You better get to bed."
"I'm sick of sleeping alone. Pretend I didn't say that."
She started to pull away from Cal, then stopped dead.
"Did you hear that? Someone's playing the piano. Delta Dawn."
She started singing.
"Delta Dawn, what's that flower you have on?"
She danced across the room.
"No one is playing music," Cal said. He glanced over at the corner where her mom's old piano sat, gathering dust. "That's the song you sang tonight for karaoke. One of them, anyway."
Ellie came to an unsteady stop and looked at Cal.
"I'm the chief of police."
"Yes."
"I got drunk on margaritas and sang karaoke in public. In my uniform."
Cal was trying not to smile.
"Look at the bright side. You didn't strip, and you didn't drive home."
She covered her eyes with her hand.
"That's my bright side? I didn't get naked or commit a crime?"
"Well, there was that time."
"I am definitely making new friends. You can go home. I won't be seeing you anymore."
She turned away from him too quickly, lost her balance, and went down like a tree at harvest time. The only thing missing was a cry of timber.
"Wow, you really hit hard."
She rolled over and lay there.
"Are you going to just stand there, or are you going to hook me up to some sort of pulley system and get me up?"
Cal was openly smiling now.
"I'm going to stand here. Us not being friends anymore and all."
"Oh, damn it. We're back on."
She reached up. He took her hand and helped her to her feet.
"That hurt,"
she said, brushing dust off her pants.
"It looked like it did."
Cal was still holding her hand. She turned to him.
It's okay, big brother. I'm not going to fall again.
Sure?
Semi-sure.
She pulled free.
Thanks for driving me home. See you back at the station at 8 sharp. The DNA will find a match. I feel it in my blood.
That might be tequila.
Naysayer. Night.
She lurched toward the stairs, grabbing the handrail just as she started to fall. Cal was beside her in an instant.
Hey,
she frowned, feeling his hold on her forearm.
I thought you left.
I'm right here. She looked at him. With her on the stair and him on the floor, they were eye to eye, and so close she could see where he'd nicked himself shaving that morning. She noticed the jagged scar along his jawline. He'd gotten that the summer he turned 12. His dad had come after him with a broken beer bottle. It was Ellie's dad who'd gotten him to the hospital.
How come you're so good to me, Cal? I was crappy to you in high school.
It was true. Once she'd sprouted boobs, plucked her eyebrows, and outgrown her acne, everything had changed. Boys had noticed her, even the football players. She'd left Cal behind in the blink of an eye, and yet he'd never made her feel bad about it. Old habits die hard, I guess. She backed up one step. It was just enough to put some distance between them.
How come you never drink with us?
I drink.
I know. I said, with us.
Someone has to drive you home.
But it's always you. Doesn't Lisa care that we keep you out all night?
He was looking at her closely. I told you. She's gone this weekend.
She's always gone.
He didn't answer. After a minute, she'd forgotten what they were talking about. And suddenly she was thinking about the girl again, and failure.
I won't find her family, will I?
You've always found a way to get what you want, Elle. That was never your problem.
Oh? What is my problem, then?
You always wanted the wrong things.
Gee, thanks.
He seemed disappointed by that, like he'd wanted her to say something else. She couldn't imagine how she'd let him down, but somehow she had. If she were sober, she'd probably know the answer. You're welcome. You want me to pick you up tomorrow morning?
No need. I'll get Jules or Peanut to give me a ride.
Okay. See ya.
See ya.
She watched him walk away, close the front door behind him. The house fell silent again. With a sigh, she navigated the narrow, too steep stairway and emerged onto the second floor. She meant to turn left to her parents', now her, bedroom, but her mind was on autopilot and steered her right into her old room. It wasn't until she saw that both twin beds were full that she realized she'd made a wrong turn. The girl was awake and watching her. She'd been asleep when the door opened. Ellie was certain of it.
Hello, little one,
she whispered, flinching when she heard the low answering growl.
I would never hurt you,
she said, backing toward the door.
I only want to help. I wish...
What did she wish? She didn't know. When she thought about it, that was the problem with her life, now and always. She'd never known what to wish for until it was too late. She wanted to promise that they'd find the girl's family, but she didn't believe it. Not anymore. Like a riverbank in a spring thaw, the erosion of Julia's self-confidence was a steady, plucking movement. No instant of it could really be seen. No giant chunks of earth fell away. But the end result was a change in the course of things, a new direction.
More and more she found herself retreating to the safe world of her notes. There, on those thin blue lines, she analyzed everything. While she still believed that Alice understood, at least at the toddler level, a few words here and there, she was making no real progress in getting the girl to speak. The authorities were breathing down her neck. Every day, Dr. Kletch left a message on the machine. It was always the same.
You're not helping this child enough, Dr. Cates. Let us step in.
This afternoon, when she'd put Alice down for her nap, Julia had knelt by the bed, stroking the girl's soft black hair, patting her back, thinking, how can I help you? She'd felt the sting of tears in her eyes. Before she knew it, they were falling freely down her cheeks. She'd had to go to the bathroom and redo her makeup for the press conference. She'd only just finished her mascara when a car drove up outside. She was halfway down the stairs when she ran into Ellie, coming up.
You okay?
Ellie asked, frowning.
I'm fine. She's asleep. Well, Peanut's waiting in the car. I'll stay here today.
Julia nodded. She grabbed her briefcase and left the house. They drove the mile and a half to town in a heavy rain. The drops on the windshield and roof were so loud that conversation was impossible. Rain seemed to be boiling on the hood. While Peanut parked the car, Julia opened an umbrella and ran for the station. She was hanging up her coat and walking to the podium when it struck her. Every seat was empty. No one had come. Cal sat at the dispatch desk, looking at her with pity. She glanced at the clock. The press conference should have started 5 minutes ago. Maybe... The door burst open. Peanut stood there, wearing her department-issue slicker, rain dripping down her face.
Where the hell is everyone?
No one showed, Cal said. Peanut's fleshy face seemed to fall at that. Her eyes rounded, first in understanding, then in resignation. She went over to where Cal stood and tucked in close to him. He took hold of her hand.
This is bad.
Very bad, Julia agreed. For the next 30 minutes, they waited in terrible silence, jumping every time the phone rang. By 4:45, no one could pretend that it wasn't over. Julia stood. I need to get back, Peanut. Alice will be waking up soon. She reached for her briefcase and followed Peanut into the car. Outside, the rain had stopped. The sky looked gray and bruised. Exactly how she felt. She knew she should make small talk with Peanut, at least answer her endless string of questions, but she didn't feel like it. Peanut turned onto Main Street. After a quick, aha, she pulled into one of the slanted parking stalls in front of the Raindrop Diner.
I promised Cal I'd get him dinner. It'll only take a jiff.
She was gone before Julia could answer. Julia got out of the car. She'd intended to get herself a cup of coffee, but now that she was here, she couldn't seem to move. Across the street was Self Park. It was where Alice had first appeared. The maple tree, now bare, sent empty branches reaching for the darkening sky. The forest in the distance was too dark to see. How long were you out there? Julia felt someone beside her. She pulled her thoughts back to the now and turned, expecting to see Peanut's smiling face. Max stood there, wearing a black leather jacket, jeans, and a white t-shirt. It was the first time she'd seen him in weeks. The avoidance had been entirely intentional. And now, here he was, looking down at her, taking up too much space and breathing too much air. Long time no see.
I've been busy.
Me too.
They stood there, staring at each other.
How's Alice?
She's making progress.
Still not talking?
She winced. Not yet. He frowned. It lasted only a second, maybe less. She thought perhaps she'd imagined it, until he said,
"Don't be frustrated. You're helping her."
She was surprised by how much those simple words meant to her. "How is it you always know what I need to hear?"
He smiled. "It's my superpower."
Beside them, a bell tinkled and Peanut came out of the diner.
"Dr. Saracen, how are you?"
Peanut said, looking from one of them to the other. She seemed certain that she'd missed something important.
"Fine. Fine. You?"
"Good," Peanut said. Max stared at Julia. She felt a little shiver move through her. It was probably from the cold.
"Well," she said, trying to follow it up with anything that made sense, but all she could do was stare at him.
"I should go," he finally said.
Later, when Peanut and Julia were in the car, driving home, Peanut said,
"That Dr. Saracen is certainly a fine-looking man."
"Is he?" Julia said, staring out the window. "I didn't notice."
Peanut burst out laughing. 16. Ellie was in the living room, reading through the missing children reports. Again, when Julia got home. She knew how the press conference had gone, by the disappointed look on her sister's face. It was one of those moments when Ellie wished she weren't so observant. She saw all the new lines on Julia's face, the pallor of her skin, and the pounds she'd lost. The woman was practically a scarecrow. Ellie felt a tinge of guilt. It was her fault that Julia was disappearing. If she had done her job better, the whole burden of identification wouldn't have fallen on Julia's thin shoulders. Amazingly, though, Julia had never once blamed her. Of course, they hardly spent any time together these days. Since the press conferences began, Julia had worked like a machine. Every hour of every day, she kept herself in that bedroom upstairs.
"No one showed," Julia said, tossing her briefcase on the sofa. There was the merest tremble in her voice. It could be exhaustion or defeat.
She sat down in Mom's favorite rocker, but didn't relax. She sat stiffly. Ellie was reminded of a sliver of pale ash that had been filed too thin. There wasn't enough left to bend without snapping in half. A silence followed, broken only by the crackling of the fire in the fireplace. Ellie glanced up the stairs, thinking of Alice.
"What do we do now?"
Julia looked down at her hands, balled up in her lap. Her sudden fragility was sad to see.
"I'm making remarkable progress, but..."
Ellie waited. The sentence remained a fragment, swallowed by the stillness in the room.
"But what?"
Julia finally looked up at her.
"Maybe I'm not good enough."
Ellie saw how vulnerable her sister was right now and knew she needed to say just the right thing. It was a talent she'd rarely possessed.
"Dad used to tell me all the time how brilliant you were, how you were going to light up the world with your brightness. We all saw it. Of course you're good enough."
Julia made a funny sound, almost a snort.
"Dad, you must be joking. All he ever thought about was himself."
Ellie was so stunned by that observation that it took her a moment to marshal a response.
"Dad? He had huge dreams for us. Well, me, he gave up on by the second failed marriage, but you were his pride and joy."
"Are we talking about Big Tom Cates, who used up all the air in the room and squashed his wife's personality?"
Ellie laughed at the sheer ridiculousness of that.
"Are you kidding? He adored Mom. He couldn't breathe without her.
And she couldn't breathe beside him. She left him once for 2 days. Did you know that? When I was 14. Ellie frowned.
"That time she went to Grandma Dottie's? She came right back.
Ellie made an impatient gesture with her hand.
The point is, they both believed in you, and it would break their hearts to see you questioning yourself. What would you do right now if you were your old self and that girl upstairs needed your help?
Julia shrugged. I'd go up and try something radical, see if a little shaking up would help.
So, do it.
And if it doesn't work,
then you'll try something else. It's not like she'll kill herself if you're wrong.
Ellie realized a second too late what she'd said. When she looked at Julia, saw her sister's pale face and watery eyes, it all finally fell into place.
That's it, isn't it? This is about what happened in Silverwood. I should have figured it out.
Some things scar you. Ellie couldn't imagine how heavy that weight was, how her sister could bear it. But there was still only one thing to say.
You've got to keep trying.
And what if I'm not helping her enough? The doctors at the care facility are assholes. She leaned forward, made eye contact.
Remember when you came home for Dad's funeral? You were in the middle of your surgical rotation. I asked you how you could stand it, knowing that if you screwed up, people could die.
Yeah?
You said, and I quote, that's part of being a doctor. You said that sometimes you just kept going because you had to.
Julia closed her eyes and sighed.
I remember. Well, now is the time to keep going. That little girl upstairs needs you to believe in yourself.
Julia glanced up the stairs. It was a long moment before she said, if I were going to do something radical, I'd need your help.
What can I do?
Julia's frown was there and gone so quickly Ellie thought she'd imagined it. Then Julia stood. Find a place in the shadows, park your butt, and sit quietly.
And?
And wait. Julia felt a surprising buoyancy in her step as she went up the stairs. Until the conversation downstairs, she hadn't even realized that she'd been quietly giving up. Not on Alice, never that. On herself. More and more often in the deepest, darkest hours of the night, she'd been questioning her abilities, wondering if she was helping Alice or hurting her, wondering about Amber and the other victims. The more she wondered about it all, the weaker she became, and the weaker she became, the more she wondered. It was a vicious cycle that could destroy her. She squared her shoulders and tilted her chin up, adopting a winner's stance. Combined with this fledgling hope of, maybe I'm still okay, it gave her the strength to open her old bedroom door. Alice lay in her bed, curled up like a little cinnamon roll. As always, she was on top of the covers. No matter how cold the room got, she never pulled the blankets over her. Julia glanced at the clock. It was nearing 6 o'clock. Any minute, Alice would wake from her nap. The child was like a Japanese train in the adherence to her routine. She woke at 5:30 every morning, took a nap from 4:30 to 6, and fell asleep at 10:45 each night. Julia could have set her watch by it. That schedule had allowed them to conduct the press conferences. She shut the door behind her. It clicked hard. She took her notebooks out of their storage box on the uppermost shelf of the closet and went to the table, where she read through her morning's notes. Today, Alice picked up our copy of The Secret Garden. With remarkable dexterity, she flipped through the pages. Whenever she found a drawing, she made a noise and hit the page with her palm, then looked up to find me. She seems to want me watching her all the time. She is still following me like a shadow everywhere I go. She often tucks her hand into my belt or the waistband of my pants and presses against me, moving with a surprising ability to gauge where I'm going. She still shows no real interest in other people. When anyone comes into the room, she races to the jungle of hers and hides.
I believe she thinks we can't see her. She's increasingly possessive of me, especially when we are not alone. This shows me that she has the ability to make attachments and bond. Unable or unwilling to vocalize this possessiveness when others are speaking to me, she uses whatever is available to make noise, hitting the wall, snorting, shuffling her feet, howling. I'm hopeful that someday soon her frustration at the limitations of these forms of communication will force her to try verbalizing her feelings. Julia picked up her pen and added, "In the past week, she's become quite comfortable in her new environment. She spends long spans of time at the window, but only if I will stand with her. I have noticed increasing curiosity about her world. She looks under and around things, pulls out drawers, opens closets. She still won't touch anything metal, and screams when an accidental contact is made, but she's edging toward the door. Twice today, she dragged me to the door and then forced me to lie down beside her. She spent almost an hour in total silence, staring at the bar of light from the hallway. The dogs were on the other side, whining and scratching to be let in. Alice is beginning to wonder what's beyond this room. That's a good sign. She's gone from fear to curiosity. Thus, I think it's time to expand her world a bit. But we'll have to be very careful. I believe the forest will exert a powerful pull on her. Somewhere out there, in all that darkness, is the place that was her home." Julia heard a movement on the bed. The old wooden frame creaked as Alice got up. As always, the girl woke up and went straight into the bathroom. She ran nimbly, almost soundlessly, across the floor and ducked into the smaller room. Moments later, the toilet flushed. Then Alice ran for Julia, tucking up alongside her, putting her tiny hand in Julia's pants pocket. She put her pen down, then gathered up her journals and notebooks and put everything on a high shelf. Alice moved soundlessly beside her, never losing contact. Julia went to the chest of drawers and withdrew a pair of blue overalls and a pretty pink sweater. "Put these on," she said, handing them to Alice, who complied. It took her several attempts to put on the sweater. She kept confusing the neck and sleeves. When she grew frustrated and started breathing heavily and snorting, Julia dropped to her knees. "You're getting frustrated. That's okay. Here, this is where your head goes through." Alice instantly calmed and let Julia help her. But she drew the line at shoes. She simply would not put them on. Finally, Julia conceded defeat. "Come with me," she said. "But your feet will be cold." She held out her hand. Alice sidled up to Julia, put her hand in the pocket again. Very gently, Julia eased Alice away from her. Then she held out her hand again. "Take my hand, Alice." She made her voice as soft as a piece of silk. Alice's breathing grew heavier. Confusion tugged at her brow and forehead. "It's okay." Long minutes passed. They both stood perfectly still. Twice more, Alice went for Julia's pocket and was very carefully rebuffed. Finally, just when Julia was considering the viability of her plan, Alice took a step toward her. "That's it," Julia said. "Take my hand." Alice's reaching out was slow, unsteady, and perhaps the most courageous moment Julia had ever witnessed. The girl was clearly terrified. She was breathing hard, trembling. The look in her eyes was of near terror, and yet she reached out. Julia held the tiny, shaking hand in hers. "No hurt," she said, looking down at Alice. Alice breathed a sigh of relief.
Holding hands, Julia led her toward the door. Alice halted as they drew close. This was the closest she'd ever really been to the door. She stared at the bright, shiny knob in horror.
It's okay. No hurt. You're safe.
Julia squeezed Alice's hand in reassurance. She didn't move. Let Alice accept the moment thus far. When the girl's trembling subsided, Julia reached for the door. Alice tried to pull back. Julia held fast to her hand, saying soothingly,
"It's okay. You're afraid, but no hurt."
She twisted the knob and pushed the door open. The hallway was revealed. Long and straight, illuminated by sconces, there were no shadows in front of them, no hidden spaces. The dogs were there. At Alice's presence, they erupted into barking, prancing movements and started to run toward her. Alice pressed against Julia. At the dog's approach, she held out one small, pale hand and made a gurgling sound in the back of her throat. The dogs stopped in their tracks and dropped to their haunches, waiting. Alice looked up at Julia. Julia couldn't make sense of it.
"Okay, Alice," she said,
not even sure what she was agreeing to, but she saw the question in the child's eye. Very slowly, Alice let go of Julia's hand and moved toward the dogs. They remained perfectly still. When Alice reached them, it was as if a switch had been turned. The dogs pounced to life, licking Alice and pawing her. Alice threw herself at the dogs, giggling hard when they nuzzled her throat. Julia soaked in the new sight of Alice's smile. Long minutes passed. Finally, Alice drew back from the dogs and returned to Julia's side. She tucked her hand in Julia's waistband.
"Come on, Alice," Julia said.
Alice let herself be pulled slowly into the hallway. Once there, she got nervous. She looked longingly back at the plants in the bedroom. When she tried to take a step backward, Julia firmly said, "This way." She led Alice to the top of the stairs. Here they paused again. The dogs followed them, moving quietly. Julia wanted to scoop Alice into her arms and carry her down each step, but she didn't dare. The girl might flail so mightily to be free that Julia would lose her hold. Instead, still holding the little hand, Julia took one step down. Alice gazed at her for a long time, obviously gauging this turn of events. Finally, she followed. They made their way down to the living room, one step at a time. By the time they reached the sofa, it was full-on night. She opened the porch door, revealing the darkness outside. The air smelled of coming winter, of dying leaves and rain-soaked grass, and the last few roses on the bushes along the side of the house. The dogs made a beeline for the yard and started playing. Alice made a quiet, gasping sound and took a step on her own, then another, until they were on the porch. The old cedar floorboards creaked in welcome. Mom's rocker was touched by the breeze and rocked to and fro. Alice was easily led now, down the steps and around the corner and into the grassy yard. The sound of the river was loud. Leaves whispered among themselves and floated downward. Thousands of them all at once, though the breeze was as soft as a baby's breath. Alice let go of Julia's hand and grabbed onto her pant leg instead. Then she dropped to her knees. She sat utterly still, her head bowed. The sound was so quiet at first, so thready, that Julia mistook it for a growing wind. Alice lifted her face to the night sky and let out a howl
that undulated on the air. It was a noise so sad and lonely that you wanted to cry or howl along with her. It made you think of all that you'd ever loved, all that you'd lost, and all the love you'd never known.
"Go ahead, Alice," Julia said, hearing the throatiness of her voice. It was unprofessional to be so moved, but there was no way to help it. "Let it all out. This is crying for you, isn't it?"
When the howling faded, Alice was quiet again. She sat there, kneeling in the grass. She was so motionless, it was as if she'd melted onto the landscape. Then, all at once, she moved. She bent forward and picked up a tiny yellow dandelion from the darkness in front of her. Julia hadn't even been able to see the flower. In a single motion, she separated the root from the stem and ate the root.
"This is the world you know, isn't it?"
Julia tried to get Alice to let go of her pants so the child could wander freely, but Alice wouldn't let go.
"I won't leave you. But you don't know that, do you? Someone has already left you out in these woods, haven't they?"
In the silence that followed the question, a crow cawed, then an owl hooted. Within seconds, the forest at the edge of their property was alive with birdsong. The unseen branches creaked and sighed. The pine needles rustled. Alice imitated each of the calls, each of her versions flawless. The birds answered her. In the darkness, it took Julia's eyes a moment to notice what was happening. The yard was full of birds. They formed a wide circle around them.
"My God!"
It was Ellie's voice from somewhere in the shadows. At the sound, the birds flew away, their wings sounding breathy and fast. Somewhere, far away, a wolf howled. Alice answered the call. A shiver crept down Julia's spine. Suddenly she was icy cold.
"Don't move," she said to Ellie when she heard a rustling in the leaves.
"But..."
"And don't talk."
Alice tugged on Julia's hand. It was the first time the girl had ever tried to lead. Julia couldn't help smiling.
"That's good, little one. I'll follow."
A cloud moved away from the moon, floated across the sky. In its wake, moonlight painted the grass, lit the river. Everything looked silvery and magical. Alice pointed at the rose bushes. They were leggy and winter bare, sorely in need of cutting back. She pulled free and approached the roses with a confidence Julia had never seen before. She straightened, lifted her chin. For once, she didn't hunch over and hold an arm across her stomach. Moonlight glanced off her hair. It looked black as a crow's wing tinged with blue. The night felt steeped in magic, shimmering with it. Stars sparkled in the sky. Julia would have sworn she could hear the ocean. She backed away slowly, letting Alice explore this perimeter of her own world. She felt her sister's approach. Ellie stopped beside her.
"How do you know she won't run away?"
"I don't. I'm betting on her attachment to me, though. There are bad memories out there for her."
"A mammoth understatement."
Julia watched Alice draw nearer to the rosebush, wondering what the girl would do if a thorn bit her flesh. Would she turn to her for help or comfort? Had she learned at all that she wasn't alone any longer? Or would she feel betrayed by this strange place and run back to the world she knew?
"Be careful, Alice," Julia said. "There are thorns."
The girl reached for a single pink bud, plucked it from the bush. Alice petted the rose with a gentleness that surprised Julia. Then she turned away. Moving slowly, she walked toward the river. When she reached a little lip of land, she paused.
Julia and Ellie followed her, both ready to save her if she jumped. But Alice kept moving down the bank to the place where the grass was tamped down and dead. There she dropped to her knees and bowed her head, howling softly. "She's calling her wolf," Julia said quietly, telling him her story and that she misses him. They waited for an answer, breath held, but all they heard were the trees whispering overhead and the river's throaty laughter. "He's at the game farm with other wolves," Ellie finally said, "too far away to hear her." Julia left Ellie standing there and moved toward Alice. Coming up behind the girl, Julia touched her shoulder. Alice turned around and peered up at Julia through eyes so dark and unfathomable they seemed to reflect the endless night sky. Julia knelt in the damp grass. "Talk to me, Alice. What are you feeling right now? You don't need to be afraid. You're safe here." The night is full of noises. Sometimes it is so loud that girl has trouble hearing the quiet that lies beneath. It has always been like that for her. She has to work hard at not hearing the animals, the insects, the wind, and the leaves. She needs to close her eyes and listen to her own heartbeat until that's all there is. Even in the moonless dark, she sees too much. A spider crawling along the ground at her feet. A pair of crows watching her from the purple tree. A moth flying along the river. In the distance, she hears the rustling movement of a hunting cat. If only the two hers would stop talking so loudly, then girl could breathe again. She feels a tightness in her chest, and it scares her. She should feel safe out here on the edge of her world. She could run away now if she wanted to. If she was careful and followed the river, she could find her cave again. All those times she stood at the lying box with her arm held out in the green-scented air, she imagined a chance like this. The moment when Sunhair would look away and girl would run. But now, she doesn't want to leave. She looks down at her feet. They are planted as firmly as any tree root. This is where she wants to be, with Sunhair. "Talk to me, Alice." Sunhair is there, in front of her, reaching a hand out to girl. In the light of this round-faced moon, everything about Sunhair is white. Girl is afraid and confused. What if Sunhair doesn't want girl to stay? Maybe she is being let go now? She doesn't want to go back to the cold, hungry darkness of her cave. Maybe him is there. Sunhair bends down. "Can you talk to me, Alice?" The other one, the big, jangling, night-haired her, says something from the shadows. There is no color around that one, no scent. Girl cannot sense what that one feels or thinks, but she knows it is bad. Something is wrong. "Leave this. Too damn spooky," Nighthair says. She shivers as if it is cold, which confuses girl even more. It is moons and moons away from cold. "Go ahead and leave. I'll stay." Sunhair is looking at girl and smiling. "I need you to talk, Alice. Is any of this making sense?" Girl hears something. It sneaks up on her like a hunting wolf. She frowns, trying to understand. "Need. Talk." Did Sunhair want girl to make the sounds that meant things? No. It couldn't be. That is the bad thing. Sunhair's smile slowly disappears. The color of her eyes seems to change from green to the palest gray. It is the color of lostness, of the water that leaks from your eyes. At last, Sunhair makes a sad, lonely sound
and straightens.
Maybe I was right, Ellen. I'm not the one to help this girl.
It seems now that Sunhair is miles away from girl and getting farther. Soon they will be so far apart that girl won't be able to find her.
I need you to talk, little one. Sunhair takes a breath. Please.
Please. From somewhere, girl remembers this sound. It is special, like the first bud in spring. Sunhair wants girl to make the forbidden noises. Girl gets slowly to her feet. She feels lightheaded with fear. Sunhair is walking away now. Leaving. Girl's fear pushes her forward. She follows, grabs Sunhair's hand, and holds so tightly it hurts. Sunhair turns to her, kneels.
It's okay, Alice. It's okay. I'm not leaving you.
Leaving. Out of the jumble of sounds, girl hears this. It is as clear as the sound of a river rising. Girl looks at Sunhair. Holding tightly to her hand, she wants to look away or close her eyes, so that if Sunhair is going to hit her, she will not have to see it coming, but she forces her eyes to stay open. It will take all her heart, everything she has inside of her, to think and remember and make the forbidden noise.
What is it?
Are you okay? Sunhair's voice is so soft it makes girl's heart ache. She looks up into those pretty green eyes. Girl wants to be good. She licks her lips, then says quietly,
Stay.
Sunhair makes a sound like a stone falling in deep water.
Did you say stay?
Girl gives her the special rose.
Peace.
Sunhair's eyes start leaking again, but this time her mouth is curled up in a way that makes girl feel warm inside. She puts her arms around girl and pulls girl toward her. It is a feeling girl has never known before, this holding of the wholeness of her. She closes her eyes and lets her face burrow into the softness of Sunhair's neck, which smells of the flowers that grow when the sun comes sneaking up through nighttime.
Stay,
she whispers again, smiling now.
Ellie sat in her dad's old chair on the porch, wrapped up in a heavy woolen blanket. Beside her, a cup of tea sent thin shoots of steam into the air.